Oh, hallelujah. Okay, I want to give you a D for your test. Make it next Wednesday, a week from today, a week from tomorrow. And your test is going to be over. What, are you disagreeing, Jana? When it's over? Yeah. It's going to cover everything from John 4, there where it deals with the nobleman's son, all the way up to the Sermon on the Mount, not including the Sermon on the Mount. But from the noble son up to the Sermon on the Mount. And that'll be next Tuesday, Wednesday, excuse me, which is the 20th. The 20th of January. Okay. Yes. Yeah, basically, you might want to check, make sure you got everything covered. I'm not sure if I'm ahead or behind of where I was last year. I'm ahead. In fact, there's some of the Sermon on the Mount that you'll have to pick up from somebody's notes. Probably. Pardon me? Okay. Yeah. It's a week from tomorrow. Yeah, Wednesday. The test is on Wednesday. Wednesday. Wednesday is the test. The 20th. Wednesday. This has happened so many times in Bible college, I can't believe it. But what will happen is I'll just slip. I don't know why this happens, but I'll slip. And I'll say, next Tuesday. No, I mean Wednesday. Next Wednesday. It doesn't matter how much I say Wednesday after that. There will be several that will think it's Tuesday. Yeah, isn't that something? It's like the first impression is the most lasting. When that thing gets on there first, it seems like no matter what you do to clean it off and put something new on there, it's hard. And that happens to me too. That's why you always want to be careful what you say about somebody to somebody else that they don't know. Because you may give them an impression that's not totally accurate. And that first impression is what's going to last. That's why when you go to your job, you know, to interview for a job, you want to be dressed nice and everything. Your first impression will be the most lasting. So if you look nice then, you know, other things can slip by later more easily. Okay. We just started on verses 27 and 28 of Matthew 5. Seeing that things, the gospel of God is in the heart. The gospel of Jesus Christ is directed to the heart. The laws of God are for the heart. Righteousness is in the heart. Sin comes from the heart. These things are in the heart. And so verse 27, 28 now, following after how the law of God did not kill, really dealt with that inner heart attitude, so also with adultery. You've heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. In his heart. And here we see how your eye is attached to your heart. Looking on her, committing adultery in his heart. Now I just was going to turn to Mark chapter 7, verses 18 through 23. We saw there how Jesus views the heart. Mark 7, 18 through 23. Let me read it. I think we started it just before we quit yesterday. But verse 21, for from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. The defilement is what comes from within and comes out. That's what's destructive. That's what's destructive. Now the scribes, they only judged the act of adultery. How are you ever going to judge if somebody is lusting in his heart? What are you going to do about that? I know that before I got saved, and I was working with iron workers in construction and sin from the old life, honestly, those men and myself were committing adultery constantly. It was a constant thing. There are men that live in the fantasy of adultery. They live with Playboy magazine. You know, it's just around them all the time. A lot of jobs, whether it's a brass or, you know, more brash, you know, the construction business and cars and, you know, that type, that draws a certain type of mentality. You find people that just, they'll live in that realm. But it's not just there. But they're living in adultery. Because it's in the heart and it's constantly being excited through the eye. Excited through the eye so that they're sinning. They're committing adultery in their heart. That's where the sin is. Now, if a person does not commit the act, but they do it in their heart, there is a difference in judgment. Because committing the act has now violated somebody else. And it's now affected somebody else. And there is a greater judgment because of that. But the sin starts in the heart. That's where it starts. And this is the higher law of holiness that takes the heart into consideration and brings the heart into purity. It's bad to be angry, but it's worse to let that anger erupt and to hurt and wound somebody else with words that you say. And it's worse yet to add to that word, those words, physical violence that could bring harm to that person, maybe even death, you know. I wouldn't doubt that my younger brother, you know, this is not as bad as a lot of things. But he was just young, and he got angry. His friend took his wagon. They were standing out front. He jerked his wagon away from him. He took his bat and just went, wow, right over his head and split his skull. And blood just poured out over his whole face, just covering it. And the other boys went screaming, and this kid was screaming. And my mom came outside, and she said that was probably one of the most harrowing experiences of her life. Because she was sure that my brother had killed him. And she said he was just covered with blood. And as it happened, it did crack the skull. And it did open it up, but it was mainly surface bleeding. And there wasn't permanent damage. And so, but it just looked horrible. And there was quite a gash. He'd probably seen it in cartoons. I don't know. Of course, we didn't really, I don't even think we had a TV back then. And, you know, but I mean, you're playing around. You don't really realize. That was worse if he just said, cut that out. It was worse to hit him with a bat, you know. It's bad when you get angry at your mate. It's worse if you say evil words. It's worse yet if you throw the pan at them, you know. There is a difference. But it depends on what's in the heart. It starts from the heart, and that's where the sin is in the heart. Now notice how the heart, eyes and the mind are associated. But if he looks upon her and lusts after her, looking and lusting, he's committed adultery in his heart. Job knew how the eyes and the mind were connected. In Job 31 and verse 1, he said, I made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid? And he goes on about how he would never commit adultery. But notice, he knew where it started. It was letting your eyes go, feeding your mind with certain pictures that your lust would feed upon, that would bring forth sin. You have to be careful what your eyes do. Your eyes, it's interesting how people look on things. People look on things differently, and your eyes greatly affect what you see. And so we have to make sure that our heart is involved rightly in things. And there are some things you can't look at. There's some things you just have to turn away from. You cannot look at them because they will hurt you. They'll put a picture in your mind. I just the other day, flipping a TV set, saw for about 2 seconds, or 4 seconds, something I wished I never would have seen. It was a horror movie. Yuck, you know? And every now and again, the devil wants to bring that thing up. And it was just horrible. I mean, that filth that they have on TV. And sometimes, I remember a couple years back going up in Nordstrom's and seeing MTV up there. I saw something up there, I just thought, God forbid that such a thing even exists in the face of the earth. let alone being put into a store. You know? Just thought, God, help us. Help this nation. And it was, you know, rock stars. It was a spiritualism type thing. I just couldn't believe it. I thought, this is sick. And, you know, those are the types of things you wish you'd never seen. Because then the devil wants to bring the picture back. Same thing with pornography. When you look on pornography, you can get a picture in your mind the devil will use to cause you to sin. That's why you have to guard your eyes. You have to watch how you look, what you see. Now, a woman can lust after a man. But she's not affected by what she sees like a man is. Men and women are built differently in their makeup, in their soul. Their souls are different in that way and because of their bodies. And a woman is more affected by what she hears. And her emotions are more involved, where a man is more affected by what he sees. And but she can, just like Potiphar's wife went after Joseph because he was a goodly person and good to look upon. See? And, I mean, you know, the men got their pinups, but the girls got their boys, you know. They got their pictures, you know, in the magazines and, you know, all the handsome guys and all of that, see? And you have to be careful what you see. It's not wrong to appreciate beauty. But what happens inside when you do? And are you giving value to a person as their eternal worth? Or are you simply going by the eye and then being drawn out in your lust? Really. You know, I really honestly, this is a truth. I've always known this is a truth. Just don't always talk about it, but to dance with somebody of the opposite sex for a long period of time is dangerous. It is. If you're not in the spirit, you're in trouble. If they're appealing to you. It's the truth. You know that's the truth. It's always been that way and always will be that way. In a spiritual experience, and having a spiritual experience, and if you're after the spirit, then things do change. They do change. But there's still the danger. There is. You know that. And you have to be careful what your eyes do. Because if it's followed by the desire. Somebody was just sharing with me that the thing was affecting them and bothering them and they couldn't look at it. It was a certain signboard had a woman on it. And just couldn't look at that. And so he had to just guard his eyes. But he got a deliverance and then it didn't matter. Just wasn't any lust there. You know, it wasn't any attraction. It wasn't any effect. And, you know, a guy that's had a real problem with alcohol, he's got to stay away from the tavern. But when he's delivered of that thing, he can get around the tavern and it doesn't bother him. He resists the temptation, but it's just not the same effect. See? And that's why you have to guard your eyes. You do have to watch what you do. Because things can be spun. In Proverbs, we see the temptations of the strange woman and the harlot mentioned several times. And again and again, it points out the attraction through the eyes. I mean, what you see. In other words, what you look upon. Proverbs 6, verse 25. She makes herself attractive. She tries to allure him and to draw him out. And he was a fool, and he followed after her, and his liver was struck through with a dart, it says. So, these things take place in the heart, and we have to be careful with what kind of images we put into our mind, what type of things we receive, what type of things we accept. And I remember one time we were witnessing down at the Seattle Center, and I was with a brother of mine, and I was witnessing to this couple, actually, particularly this one girl, and trying to get through to her and so forth. And later he said, "Boy, I don't know how you could ever witness to her." It was during the summer, and she was hardly dressed. I mean, and... But I didn't even really notice it. And I thought back on it later. I thought, boy, you know, you're right. You know, because you think in your mind again of the picture of the person. But I was so involved with her soul. And with this other guy and talking with him and trying to break down the demonic barrier that was there for the gospel. That I didn't even notice it. And it's, you know, it's not always that way. But that time it was. You can see how you can be in a place, in the spirit, but see, now what are you seeing? You're seeing something different. You can look at a person and see a soul. Or you can look and just see a body. Or you can look and just see a memory. Or you can look and see certain impacts of different kinds. See? And all of these things coming out of the heart. What what fans certain things in your heart. See, that's why you have to be careful. You have to be careful what you see. You have to be careful what you think. You have to be careful all those things because of what it can cause inside. And so you make sure that you're walking in a place where your heart is fulfilled in God, and you're not allowing other things to draw out lust and entice. And so it brings us then to this next point, verses 29 and 30. Ties right in. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. The right eye and the right hand. These are definitely the most used and the most important members of your body. You see your right hand more than any other spot on your body. Like I said before, unless you're a woman, then it's your face. But if you're a man, I mean, normally. No, I'm just kidding. But it's your right hand. That's what you see most of the time. That's what you're using. That's what you're involved with. It's in front of you. It's your right hand. It's the most important member of your body. And your right eye. And speaking and representing your sight. It's interesting, some people feel that right-handedness and left-handedness is determined by which eye is stronger. And I don't know if that's really true, but I've read that and I've heard it. And it's not proven, but it's a possibility. Some feel that. If you're a parent and you try to change your child that was left-handed to right-handed, you better not. And it doesn't work. And if it does work, you're probably going to be in trouble because it can really affect them. There's a way that people see it's affected by the mind and which side of the body they use, and it all seems to be linked together. And it's interesting how left-handed people will tend, at least some of them, will tend to flip things because so many things are right-handed. And because they're always having to turn things around, they tend to do that in other things, even letters and numbers and all sorts of things. So those are the things that are closest to you. That is, closest to your heart. That is, closest. They are the greatest extensions of your heart. Your right hand, your right eye. They express you more. They are the extension of it most. They're closest to you and mean the most to you. If they are to offend you, if you are to find an avenue where your heart sins through you continually, even though it's the closest thing to you, cut it off and save yourself rather than keeping that and destroying your whole body. You know that if you get gangrene, you got to cut it off. And it's better to lose that than to lose your whole life. It's absolutely amazing to us that foxes and raccoons, when caught in a trap, will actually chew off the leg caught in the trap rather than die. Maybe you heard Ezra Cassell talk about a three-legged coon. He said you've never seen an animal run faster and be more wary of traps than a three-legged coon. He said they run faster than four-legged coons because they've learned something. Those experiences in life teach you things. You're better off without your right hand, without your right eye. And to have that be the member through which you are offended. Now, offend here means to snare or to stumble. And the Greek term, skandalizo, primarily denotes a trap stick or a trigger. It's the thing that when you touch, sets everything else off. When you touch it, everything else goes. It's that trap stick. It's that trigger. That's the thing you have to watch. So, It can refer to those extensions of your heart or the things that are the closest to your heart. If those things are means through which you are stumbled, that is, through which you are snared, it is better to cut them off, no matter how important they are to you, than to be destroyed by them. We see an example in the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy chapter 13, and verse 6, following. If thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend, which is as thine own soul, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers, namely of the gods of the people which are round about you, nigh unto thee or far off from thee, from the one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth, thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him. Neither shall thine eye pity him, neither shalt thou spare, neither shalt thou conceal him, but thou shalt surely kill him. Thine hand shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones that he die, because he has sought to thrust thee away from the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. And all Israel shall hear and fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you. Wow! Could you imagine putting your own wife to death? Your friend, your brother, your son, your daughter? I mean, those are the closest to you. Even they, if they try to snare you, must be cut off in order to save your life. This is really serious. In the body of Christ, the same thing is true. Paul says, put out the leaven. For a little leaven leavens the whole lump. He said, therefore I do not want that wicked person among you. Put him out. Because he committed incest. That's found in 1 Corinthians 5, verses 6, 7, and 11. In other words, basically, do anything to stay out of hell. Do anything to stay out of hell. There are true stories of those that in pioneer days have mangled a leg or something, and there's no doctor. You're out there in the middle of the wilderness. Infection sets in. What can you do? They had to cut their leg off. There's no anesthesia. There's no anesthesia. They would saw their leg off to save their life. My, can you imagine that? But they had to do it. Ugh. When your life is at stake, you'll be surprised what you'll do. When some big hammer comes down to put a crushing blow that would take your life to your head, what do? You throw up your arm. You're willing to lose your arm. You'll let your arm be crushed and broken and lose it in order to save your life. You will. That's the way we're made. And Jesus is saying, if that thing, though it's your right hand, if it causes you to offend, it's better to lose it. Now, obviously there's nothing in the right hand or in the eye. It's the extension of the heart. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about that item that is closest to us, that thing, that person, that situation, that sport, that hobby, that place to live, that object, whatever it is, that is so close to you, that it snares you and stumbles, but it stumbles you and snares you, then it must be cut off to save your own life. Jesus said, if you love anything more than me, you're not worthy of me. If there's anything in the way that will take you away from the Lord, then you're not worthy of him. This scripture was taken literally by a guy after U of Dub. He actually cut off his right hand and put out his right eye. He was demonized. He wasn't a born-again person. He was the devil. You know how spiritists take the Bible and play with it and so forth. He was had some real problems. The devil drove him to that. Didn't help him a bit. It's really sad. Verse 31 and 32. Now this fits right with the same thing. It's another common problem to the Jews, but it ties right in with this area. It has been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, commits adultery. There's another common problem to the Jews, divorce. It had become an occasion to the flesh. Yes, it was said to them of old time in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1, write a bill of divorcement. They eventually allowed divorce for any cause. And divorces were common at the time of Jesus. The teaching of the school of Shammai was stricter. They did not allow a divorce for any cause. But the general school of the rabbis and many of the Pharisees allowed divorce for any cause. And so they were common. But we can see here from what Jesus said. He says, though you divorce them, if they marry another, they commit adultery. What does that tell you? That tells you that in God's eyes, they were never divorced. God joined them together and that's it. He never put them asunder. Though they did write up a bill of divorcement, God never honored it. And so they were causing adultery. Now at times God would honor it. Jesus said, the cause of fornication. So there are times when God does say, you're divorced. That's it. You're right. You're separated. And but if they're not, in God's eyes, divorced, then if they go to another, it's adultery. And so the Lord is saying what? What is He saying? He's saying divorce is in the heart. And people that play the game that, well, yeah, I've divorced him in my heart, that doesn't count. There's something else that here is at stake. Now, let's look at this for a moment. The word fornication. This is a broad term basically pointing to any illicit sex in or out of marriage. Here, obviously, fornication is in marriage because he's talking about those that have been married. So a fornication can be adultery. Adultery is generally more restricted to those that are married. Fornication is a broader term. And Jesus allowed divorce for fornication. Why? Because it constituted a true separation. Because now that mate had become one with another. They've been joined to another, been one with them. And there was a true separation. There we see in this fornication that the union that had been disannulled in her heart and in her body, and therefore she could be put away and would be put away. And he was free to put her away. But what if she did commit fornication? But it was under a powerful temptation out of which she repented. And she came back to her husband pleading mercy and acceptance. Now do you think it'd be all right? See, what is Jesus getting at? He's looking at a common problem among the Jews and he's dealing with them for where they are. What he's really teaching, though, is that these things are in the heart. These things are in the heart. Does this mean, therefore, that, well, except for the cause of fornication, well, my wife looked upon that man and lusted after him and therefore has committed adultery in her heart, I divorce her. Is God going to accept that? Oh, he's not going to accept that. See, we're talking about something deeper, much deeper, and more true to real life. As far as in the type, God would never put away his people for a weakness that they repented of. Never. God would never put away his people if they were trying. God doesn't put away his people the first time they sin, or the second, or the third. God bears long with his people. And this is the type in marriage. This is the type. We do see an example where God did put away his people, though, in Jeremiah chapter 3, verses 6 through 8. And there they had gone a-whoring year after year, generation after generation. And they had joined themselves to idols, other nations. The Lord said also unto me in the days of Josiah the king, hast thou seen that which backsliding Israel has done? She has gone up upon every high mountain and under every green tree, and there has played the harlot. And I said after she had done all these things, turn thou unto me. But she returned not, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. God finally did cut off and divorce Israel. He did. And they're called the lost tribes of Israel. They're cut off. And they have been lost. And they didn't return. There are representations of them among the Jews. But in general, northern Israel was lost. God divorced them. They're cut off. But even then, you know, it seems like Paul teaches in 1 Corinthians. It says, but if they will be reconciled later, be reconciled unto thy mate. And that's what's going to happen to Israel. Though they have been divorced, yet God is going to bring them back through the gospel. In the end of time, there's going to be 144,000 from the 12 tribes. No. In my opinion, no. You're not bound to be never married again. In my opinion, see, we'll get into this a little bit more fully as we go along. Jesus is pointing out that the Jews took things and lived by the letter. And because of that, they died. The letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. And he's giving an understanding that deals with the heart of the issue and what the real sin is. What is the real sin? What really actually happens? And Paul talks about, I mean, Jesus does give allowance for a divorce, but he says for the cause of fornication. Well, now, if we take that by the letter, we're not learning what Jesus is saying. We're not realizing that Jesus is speaking according to the real issue. What does fornication represent? Paul teaches, and we know this, that he that goes into a harlot is made one with that harlot. There's a oneness that's achieved. I'll tell you, adultery is a very horrible sin. It really is. It's a destructive sin. It's a real curse. Because there's something that happens when adultery is committed to the person. There's something that happens to them. And there's even probably a spiritual thing that happens. And it's a defilement and a violation. And you read about it there in Proverbs chapters 5 and 7 and 9. And you can see that it's a hateful sin. And the, of course, the typology is also it's showing something of God that he is not. Now, there's several things that come into play. First of all, he's only speaking of it from the man's standpoint, because the man's the only one that could divorce. The woman couldn't divorce. Secondly, when he says for the cause of fornication, he's speaking to something that's deep. And what we see here is that in fornication, one, and we're talking about somebody that is living in it. They've given themselves to it. It's not just one thing they did and repented of. We're talking about a giving of heart, that they have actually become one with another. In soul, body, they have adulterated from their original mate. They have adulterated and they've given their life over. There are some that have done that to demons. I know of a situation where a woman was married to a man. He wouldn't commit sex because that was part of his demonology. Commit sex. I mean, you know, he wouldn't have sex with anybody. And neither with his wife. And he tortured her, beat her. He despised her. He treated her like filth. She was a Christian. She finally divorced him and was righteous before God in doing so. I mean, he was not married to her. She had every reason to surprise him. She stayed on as long as she did. Now, he wouldn't commit fornication with anybody, but neither would he give her her just due. He was joined to demons. He had definitely gone off, and in my opinion, she was righteous. And is she now unable to marry anybody else? No, I feel like God allowed that a divorce. I feel like God counted that as a true divorce. And Paul says it's better to marry than to burn. But he gave a suggestion. He said that if you have divorced, I counsel you not to seek a mate. But then on the other hand, he says, you younger widows, marry. You know, he said, if you know, it's a problem. You've got the needs. And it's a natural thing. And so in your situation, he says they haven't sinned. And then, you know, and so forth. And he talks about how one is free. He is not bound. One is free. And in certain situations, when God has accepted the divorce. But then in other cases, and see, this is the situation. When two are spirit-filled and they're married, and it's their flesh, their carnality, it's not wanting to make it, and they want a divorce. They can divorce all they want. God's not going to accept it. God's not going to accept it. And if they go to another, they're adultery. That's what they've done. They've committed adultery. Well, then what about the original mate now? Is it going to be adultery if they ever get married again? In my opinion, no. I think that there comes a time if their mate has gone off and committed adultery and has gone off, then they're in this class. Their mate has totally taken away their heart, life, and everything else and has violated the vow. Has violated that, and there is a time when God accepts that divorce, as it were. Now, they may get divorced before God gave them a divorce. You understand what I'm saying? They may get divorced long before that other mate finally goes off. They're just upset at each other, so they divorce. Whatever. And then that mate finally goes off, drifts off, and goes and marries somebody else. And then at that point, you know, maybe God gives them a divorce. But, you don't know. You don't know all these things. The issue is, it's in the heart. That's the issue. It's in the heart. And marriage is a very solemn thing. It's a covenant vow of giving your life. You don't even own your own body. Your mate owns your body. And so you have responsibility to them. The situation at Christ's time was common divorce without true cause. And still to this day in Arabia, they have common divorce in many cases. Now, it's not so common. I mean, I should say easy divorce. All you have to do is say, I divorce you three times, and that woman's out the door. And what she has on is all she gets. That's it. It's over. If he's mad enough to say it three times, that's it. It's solemnized right there. And I'm not sure how much they carry it out, but that is the law. You know, there's laws in the United States we don't carry out, too. But that was the way it was. Now, he's talking about people that are in the covenant. And he's not covering every legal aspect of divorce and remarriage. He's only addressing the moral responsibility and where the sin is committed in the heart. And really, these situations get really sticky. They get really sticky. And ultimately, we know this. On one hand, there is a vow that is made before God, and God has joined two together. And the Bible says, "Don't let no man put asunder." And there is a responsibility before God. And if they are put asunder by man, whether God allows it or not, depends. Whether God really recognized it as a divorce or not, depends. And that's a scary issue. And in that point, people have a responsibility before God. They stand before God. But he did allow it for the hardness of their hearts. And so, it is allowable at times. It's not that divorce is never is, and God will never accept it. He does at times. And people, even if God doesn't accept it, God still sees the hardness of their hearts, and he gives them that opportunity so that they don't sin even worse. You know, that's all you can say. So God deals with people where they are. That's the issue. But as far as, number one, the type is the type of the highest relationship in the universe, and that is the church to Christ. Number two, it deals with the deepest things that are in us. The giving of our life, when you give of your body, and you give of your soul, and in a joint relationship. And God has put into the marriage relationship the highest pleasures, fulfillment, and meaning of any relationship here on earth. And of course, you can have deeper relationships. You can have friends in a different relationship, you know, and so forth. But as far as what God wants, it should be the deepest relationship. In the typology it is. That doesn't mean it always will be, but typologically it is. And people are only capable of what they're capable of. But as far as the reverence due, it is a covenant before God that is to be held. And it's a very grave responsibility to be married. Not a light thing. But it's not the end of the world, you know. I mean, if a person sins there, people have sinned doing all kinds of things. You know, it's not like at that you cease to live. If you do that, then you no longer live. You know, that's not true. Life goes on, you know. And you have to just face what the issues are later on down the road. I think it's absolutely foolish how some have taught that if you get saved, you have to go back to your original mate four mates ago, you know. That's totally ridiculous. And I think that theology has been largely dumped. But this is talking about it's talking to those that are in the covenant. You're not responsible in your new life for every mistake you made in the old life. That is for sure. That is for sure. Thank God for that. God deals with us where we are. And see it again, it deals with the heart. Now, I'd like to turn, dealing with the same subject, to Matthew 19, verses 3 through 12. Because the same thing comes up again. Jesus says some pretty interesting things. It also gives us some insight into the situation in their day. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. What he basically gave was the intent of God. The intent of God in marriage was two people being made one. That's what his intent was. So he's giving the heart of God. They say unto him, Why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement to put her away? They want to hold on to every straw they can. He said unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts. Notice he didn't say their hearts. Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning it was not so. He said you could. But that's not what God's intent was. It's not what God was looking for. I'm telling you, we're not living under the law. We are living under the Spirit. And if you have difficulties in the marriage relationship, you have now found your crucible by which you can come to perfection. It's true. What better place to die to self? The hardest things are the things that are closest to you, are they not? Those are the most difficult to handle in within our own nature and character. Well, so it is with relationship. But it's also the greatest blessing when it's overcome. So, verse 9, "And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, commits adultery. And whoso marries her which is put away doth commit adultery." In other words, God is saying, he's not accepting it. God doesn't accept it except for fornication. His disciples say unto him, "If the case of the man be so with his wife, it is not good to marry." I mean, they were pretty down in the mouth about it. They thought, oh, wow, if that's really the way it is, I don't ever want to get married. Because, I mean, what if she's got this problem or that problem? I mean, I've got to be able to divorce her. I can't put up with that. You got to give me a chance in this thing, Jesus. I can't just, I mean, forever and ever and ever and ever. It's better not to marry than if you have to do that. They were scared by what he was teaching. But he said unto them, and he basically was telling them, no, you don't have to be a eunuch. No, that's not what God is saying. I'm not saying that you have to be a eunuch or you're never going to make it in the kingdom of heaven. Because he says this. But he said unto them, all men cannot receive the same, save they to whom it is given. For there are some eunuchs which were so from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men, and there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. Yeah, there is a time when you don't marry. But this is not given to all, and it's for him that can receive it. There are some eunuchs that were born that way from their mother's womb. That's right. They, because of a mutation, are unable to produce seed. They're like a steer. You ever notice the difference between a steer and a bull? A steer is a castrated bull. And it never develops the strong frame, the strong muscles, and it never has the urge to mate. Eunuchs are men that are castrated, so they never have a desire for women. It's a hormonal thing. And there just is not the desire when the hormones are not coming into the body. And the organs, are the testicles, are that which put the hormone into the system. It's just like with the female to the ovaries. And those hormones do a lot to our bodies. Physically, emotionally, a lot of things are done to our bodies by those. Talk to women that have gone through menopause. They never knew their bodies were on such a string. They never knew they were so close to emotional collapse. They never knew that their body was so easily tipped by some hormones and the effect that it could have on their being and the way they feel about themselves and the way they feel about life and the way they feel about everything. There are some that eunuchs are made that way of men, like in harems. And there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Like Paul. He did not marry. He chose not to marry. Because he wanted to be free to minister in the gospel without that responsibility in this life. Because marriage is for this life. Marriage is for this life. He did not want to have that responsibility. It does take a lot of your time. It does. It's a real maturing process. And I recommend it to everybody. But if God has given you that, and you hear that saying, and you feel that calling, and you're able to, like Paul says, to contain yourself, then don't get married. But you know what happens a lot? People that don't get married, the problem is not that they're so great and called of God, and they've got this high calling. It's because they're scared to death of marriage. They're scared to death of people of the opposite sex. And they've got a tremendous need inside, and they're unwilling to face it. They've got a problem. They've got a problem. It's not because they're spiritual. But, you know, God will allow that too. I mean, I don't care what you do. I mean, if you do it for the wrong motivation maybe, but you do it as unto the Lord, God bless you. If that's the way you really feel and you're able to do that as unto the Lord. Of course, there was in 1 Corinthians 7 where Paul talks about that. He just said, he did say, for the present distress, I recommend. Because of the pressure and the call of the ministry and the persecution that was going on. I mean, it was difficult for Peter to take his wife about in the apostolic ministry. That had been difficult, a lot harder than it would be for Paul. He didn't have to worry about that. So he could get stoned one day, raised up the next, do whatever he wanted. He didn't have to worry about anything. Those that had been persecuted in communist prison camps, Harlan Popoff said, the ones who had the greatest problem were those that were married. Because they would torture them through threats against their family and their wife. And many of them would break under those kind of tortures because they couldn't stand to see their wife go through those things, their children. It was just too much for them. Whereas the young men didn't care. Beat me, tear my tongue out, you know, burn me at the stake. I'm not signing anything, you know. They just didn't care. All they had to lose was their life, and they'd already given that to Jesus, so they didn't have to worry about their family and their kids and other things. So Jesus is basically balancing their overreaction, because they're overreacting and saying, oh, I'm not going to get married. No, that's only for those who hear it. Now, it's interesting. You know Origen? You've heard about Origen? When he was young, he castrated himself for the kingdom of God's sake. He took this verse literally. Some are eunuchs for the kingdom of God's sake. But that didn't mean that. It didn't mean to dismember your body at all. But that's what he did. And he went through a lot of persecution, different areas also. Okay, so there are only some that have the gift, as it were. That's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 7. Not all have the gift. Not all have the gift. Some of us tried to have it. I did. And I was upset, frankly, when my wife came along and she affected me so much. I really was. I treated her like dirt for a long time because I was upset inside that she affected me, you know, so much. And I finally quit resisting and we got married. And I've been grateful. I'm thankful. She's a godly woman, a wonderful wife. Precious. Okay, so there you have again the heart, the heart relationship. And so in the area of sin, in the sexual areas, sin is in the heart. And the divorce, I mean, it deals with what is actually happened. And you can't fool God. You can say, well, yeah, we're just divorced in the heart because we don't love each other anymore. Yeah, but why and what? What has happened? Is there any reverence to the covenant of God? What's going on inside? Has there actually been made a oneness? I mean, what is going on? It's just because you're carnal and you're fleshly and you're unwilling to honor what God has said. That's what's happened. And I tell you, in that kind of relationship, there's a lot of benefit that can come if they'll break before the Lord and seek God together and their marriage can be restored. But sometimes they just won't, and that's just the way it is. All right, next section, verses 33 to 37. This deals with another problem of the Jews, and Jesus is going to show what the law of God said, and then he's going to deal with what is really meant to be, what God really meant when he said it. Again, you have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself. In other words, thou shalt not falsely swear, or swear falsely against yourself. In other words, make an oath and then break it. But you shall perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. What is he talking about here? In Leviticus 19 and verse 12, it tells you not to swear falsely. That is, to make an oath and then break it. And why did God say that? He said that because he wanted people to be truthful in the heart so that you meant what you said. To forswear, it means literally to swear falsely. It's a person that perjures himself. He makes an oath and then he breaks it. He vows before God, I tell you the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God, me God. And then he lies. That's a person that has forsworn himself. He has perjured himself. There's a very strong penalty to those that are perjurers. The word swear means to promise with an oath. To forswear means to go against your oath. Now the Jews had made oath-taking common. It no longer was reverent like it was in the Old Testament. And they made oaths based on things. And they gave different degrees of power to these things. And therefore, their oaths carried with them different degrees of power. So sometimes, you would make a vow of great power because you vowed by, you know, the gold of the temple. And but another time, you might vow by the temple. And that's just too general. And so that doesn't have the same power as the gold of the temple. And so they'd make that oath, and then they'd say, Rabbi Ban Kochba, I will be there before the temple. I swear by the temple. I will be there tomorrow at the third hour. Third hour comes around, he doesn't show.
And so Rabbi Zachari, he hunts down Rabbi Ben Bakai and he throttles him and he says, "Why did you do that to me?" And he says, "But Rabbi, I swore by the temple." "Oh, okay." He lets him off. "Hey, what's going on here? What is this?" The oath did not have as much power in it because he swore by the temple instead of by the gold of the temple or by something else. See? And so everything in you had to know what had more power than other things. See? And it became kind of a game. And they made oath-taking common. Now, when does oath-taking become common? It's when your word loses its value. When do you promise to do something? When you're not sure they'll trust you by just telling them. "I'll be there tomorrow at 10. They keep looking at you, staring narrowly. What's the next thing that comes out of your mouth? "I promise!" Why? Because you knew they didn't trust you. Now, if you were a man of your word and everything you said you always did, if you said, "I'll be there tomorrow at 10, they'd say, "Thanks. We'll see you then." If it was a real important thing, they wouldn't even have to say anything else. They'd just take your word because you're a man of your word. Right? You wouldn't have to promise anything because you said you would do it. So oath-taking becomes common when your general word is devalued. Let's look at an example of that in Matthew 23, 16 through 22. Jesus hated this particular thing that they did. He brings it up again. "Woe unto you, you blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing. But whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he is a debtor. You fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whosoever shall swear by the altar, it is nothing. But whosoever swears by the gift that is upon it, he is guilty. You fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Whosoever, therefore, shall swear by the altar, swears by it and by all things thereon. And whoso shall swear by the temple, swears by it and by him that dwells therein. And he that shall swear by heaven, swears by the throne of God and by him that sits upon." What do we see here? We see that an oath, a vow, Jesus is saying that if you make an oath, you are vowing before God. And I don't care if you say altar, temple, gold, or nothing. When you make a vow, it is before God, because God is the one who heard your word. And therefore, you must keep it. They also, the Pharisees, were. They said that public oaths were very binding. But they felt like unofficial and unpublic oaths were not as binding. You can see that all they wanted to do was make an impression on man. And this kind of game playing has also been done, even in our day and age, different ways. Back in the 1800s, when you were in the court and you kissed the Bible, you know, you'd swear over the Bible that you'd tell the truth and you'd kiss the Bible, and sometimes a guy would lie. And they'd call him on and say, "Hey, you lied." And he says, "No problem, sir. I kissed my thumb." So they held the Bible in their hands, and instead of kissing the Bible, they kissed their thumb. That made it okay to lie. Because they didn't kiss the Bible. Well, you know, it's just like a guy that says, you know, when you're a kid, "Can I buy your bike tomorrow?" And you know the guy is not going to, you know, I'll bring it back. "Can I borrow it?" "And I'll bring it back. I'll have it tomorrow back to you at noon." You know he won't bring it back. You know he's a liar. And he says, "Cross my heart, hope to die." Now that makes a difference. If he crosses his heart and hopes to die, now you can lend him your bike. So you lend him your bike. He doesn't get it back by noon. And you're about ready to break the guy's neck. You say, "Why didn't you get my bike back?" And he says, "I had my fingers crossed." Right? Double cross. Double cross. And then so the next time he asks you, you say, "Okay, let me see your hands." He puts his hands up. Then he goes away and he had his legs crossed. He comes back a third time and say, "All right, I'm about ready to nail you. I know you need my bike and you want to borrow it. I'm not going to let you have it." But you say, "Cross your heart, hope to die. Come on, get your arms out, legs out. Okay, see if I can see this guy." He walks away later. As he walks away, he pulls out two toothpicks that are crossed, tied together with a string. You know, and the guy's a liar. The guy is a liar. And all those oaths don't change that fact. And so an oath will not bind a liar, and an honest man doesn't need an oath. And that's why Jesus said, "Swear not at all." I'll give that to you tomorrow again so you can get that. That's an important point. Thanks.